there is no right answer, and that's why we need an oversight board, because the current situation is there's no right answer, we have to make them, and it feels like we're making them in a black box, even despite all of the many transparency efforts the company has made in terms of releasing the minutes of our product policy forum, which is the meeting where we talk about what policy decisions we're going to make, despite releasing transparency reports. All of these things are out in the open, and people still feel like they don't have a view into the discussions that are being had in Silicon Valley about what's allowable and what's not allowable on these platforms that have a huge influence over speech, not just in the US where these companies are based, but globally and around the world.
I'm Quinta Juresic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 14th, 2019. Today we're bringing you a new episode from our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation in the run-up to the 2020 election. My colleague Evelyn Dweck spoke with Zoe Darme, manager of Facebook's Global Affairs and Governance team. Darme is leading the global outreach efforts in support of Facebook's Oversight Board, a new body that will have the power to review policy and content moderation decisions made by the platform. Facebook has long been plagued by complaints about unreliable and arbitrary decisions, about what does and doesn't appear on the site, and the Oversight Board is an experiment in incorporating greater transparency and accountability. But the development of the board raises a lot of questions. What should this kind of oversight body look like? How will it remain independent? And will Facebook users trust the board's decisions? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 472. Zoe Darme on the Facebook Oversight Board.
So, Zoe Darme, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. If you could just start by telling us what your role at Facebook is.
Sure. Thanks, Evelyn. I'm really excited to be here, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to talk about the Oversight Board. My role in particular is to support the engagement on the Oversight Board before we actually roll it out at the beginning of next year. And the reason for this isn't just to get people to know about it or to raise public awareness, but really to get feedback from as many external partners as possible to inform the decisions that we make about this oversight board before we actually launch it. And so to us, it's really important that there is a co-design process that's put in place before we launch something that's so momentous and has a lot of moving parts.
Great. So let's step back just for a second and talk about you and your role to working on this team. So
yeah.
I think you started with a Victorian literature major, then you were working at the Department of Justice,
correct,
and then you went to the UN, and now you are at Facebook. How did you end up at Facebook? What were you doing at the UN, and what brought you to Facebook to work on this?
Yes. So I have been extremely unqualified for every job that I've ever had. And so I was getting my PhD in Victorian literature at Johns Hopkins, and Washington, D.C. happened to be the next biggest city. And randomly, very randomly, I ended up copy editing for a Department of Justice agency called the COPS Office, which was this tiny little office, a grant-making office in D.C., and it was doing police reform. This was pre-Trayvon Martin, pre-Philando Castile. We had no resources, no attention, no political will, but we're doing a lot to kind of move the needle on policing. And from there, I moved over to the UN in a policing role again and very quickly moved to the broader rule of law area. And so at UN peacekeeping, I was working on building rule of law systems in conflict and post-conflict countries. And so I think that that is what some recruiter at Facebook found on my LinkedIn profile, was that there was a person who had an international background and working on rule of law systems. And since this board kind of borrows from some of those traditions, I think that's why I ended up kind of contacted by Facebook to see if I'd be interested in working on this thing at the time, which was nameless, but known somewhat colloquially as the Facebook Supreme Court. And so that's actually how I ended up at Facebook about a year ago.
Okay, cool. So we'll come back to the name, the Facebook Supreme Court, maybe in a minute. But just on that, so is that really what this project is about, or conceived of as kind of bringing the rule of law to Facebook? Is that kind of what you're doing?
I mean, essentially what it's doing is it's putting a system of procedural justice, I think, around some of our content decisions. And also the aspect that's similar between what we were trying to do at the UN and what we're trying to do here is just build transparency into the decisions that we make. One of the things that I think the UN is good at is bringing a lot of different stakeholders together who may have very different interests and very different motivations, and trying to figure out what is the common denominator and the way forward for building systems in a place that didn't have them before because they were just coming out of conflict. Now, that may sound quite ambitious and quite different from what we're doing at Facebook, but really, in a way, it's similar because we're building something from scratch, first of all. And second of all, there are so many stakeholders who are involved and interested in this area of content governance that I think really the experience of consulting hugely different stakeholders from vastly different backgrounds is the red thread between the work that I was doing at the UN and now the work that I'm doing here at Facebook.
Okay. So do you actually envisage this process or this board being able to bring more harmony between these very, very different stakeholders and sort of different communities? And you know, it's possibly the most diverse community, if it even is a singular community ever assembled on the face of the earth. These, you know, 2-point-something billion right. people, users from all sorts of different communities that have very different understandings of what is free speech and where the appropriate line is. So is the board hoping to sort of harmonize some of that?
Sure.
Is that the goal?
It's interesting that you use the word harmony and harmonize. It's one that gets thrown around at the UN a lot, and one that doesn't accurately represent what it looks like to be in a negotiation with 193 member states.
Cacophony rather than harmony. Yeah.
Exactly. But I do think that's somewhat right, because what's similar is that the oversight board is really looking at building a process to ensure that many different voices are heard before a consequential decision is made about what's allowed to be said or not to be said. I mean, that's a decision that has consequences for people, and that people feel is quite important and that has impact on their daily lives. And so I think that there should be a transparent process around that, and also a public communication about what the decision making was behind the ultimate decision that's taken. To me, that's the real value of the oversight board. And I think that's also the value of a multi-stakeholder approach, which is sometimes invoked in terms of talking about the oversight board. So that's what we're hoping to go towards. And if we can bring more light around these really difficult conversations about free expression, then I think that that's added value that we may not have had before.
So, I mean, that's something that I've written about a fair bit in my work on the oversight board, is I also see that as potentially one of the biggest benefits that this can bring, is sort of more transparency and public reasoning about these really hard calls that potentially there is no one right answer to what is hate speech. I mean, there almost definitely is no one right answer, and that people are going to agree on. But when I put that argument forward in sort of academic circles or whatever, I often get the response that these are intractable disputes. Mm-hmm. Because there is no one right answer, actually more transparency might just make things worse for Facebook, might just make it make people more angry and make it perceived as more illegitimate. Is that something that you fear that keeps you up at night at all?
I mean, yes, there was an interesting response. We did the whole consultation talking to more than 2,000 people, and we put out a report that said this group of people said this group of people said that. And it was really clear that there was not a ton of consensus around a lot of these decisions. And so some people took that as, there's no consensus, Facebook, you're definitely going to fail because there's no like one right answer. And to me, it was more of a situation like, yes, there is no right answer. And that's why we need an oversight board, because the current situation is there's no right answer. We have to make them, and it feels like we're making them in a black box, even despite all of the many transparency efforts the company has made in terms of releasing the minutes of our product policy forum, which is the meeting where we talk about what policy decisions we're going to make, despite releasing transparency reports. All of these things are out in the open and people still feel like they don't have a view into the discussions that are being had in Silicon Valley about what's allowable and what's not allowable on these platforms that have a huge influence over speech, not just in the US where these companies are based, but globally and around the world. So that's why I think it's important, but happy to entertain any criticism.
I'm sure you have entertained much criticism. So let's talk about some of that and the, and the global feedback process that you you went through, and maybe just outline for our listeners, you know, how long it was, what was involved, how many people you spoke to, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I think people have recognized is that we have done the work. We started even before we released our draft charter for the Oversight Board in January. We had some small kind of roundtables to talk about the potential for this idea. But then really the whole consultation started ramping up between January and around June to July of this year. And the feedback process is ongoing. We're still talking to people. We're still refining our ideas. But essentially, we knew that we were building something that had so much influence, I guess, or ramifications for people just outside of the people who were working at Facebook, that it was really important to get their views. We've made a lot of changes based on what we've heard. A lot of changes.
Such as,
originally we were going to just select the first members and then pass off selection to the board itself. We've changed our thinking on that because everyone said, wait, you're building an independent board and you're choosing all the members. That doesn't sound right. So we have changed that. We will choose a few members and then have them choose with us for the first group and then switch the selection over to the board itself. Another huge decision that we made in response to feedback was originally we thought maybe the board would just review our decisions in a handful of cases, and their decisions would be binding on those individual cases. People said to us, if there's no influence over policy, then why are you even doing this? If you're just going to hear a couple dozen cases, that's just a drop in the bucket. And so we have said that the board will also make advisory policy recommendations based on the cases that it hears. So that's a pretty major decision that we've made in response to feedback. There are many micro decisions as well.
What was the biggest surprise that you had out of the feedback process? Was there anything that particularly, like, that you just weren't expecting to hear from people that really shocked you?
I mean, there have been some zany ideas, for sure.
Okay.
why don't you just leave every content decision up to a citizen jury, for example?
Amazing.
The thing I like about that is the democratic element. I get the reason that people would want that to happen. The worry is that then the somehow the whole platform turns into Bodie McBoatface. So I'm not sure if that's
that would actually be wonderful, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that
I think
was
we've solved this, Zoe.
Fully thought through. So there have been the zanier portions of the consultation, but then what I actually was surprised about is how much thoughtful feedback we got through an online public consultation process that was open to anyone, anywhere. There were a lot of responses that we didn't publish because we only published responses where we had consent to share, and some people really felt like they wanted to share their ideas privately, and we understand and respect that. But even in the public responses, I have to call out one extraordinarily smart intern at the Council on Foreign Relations who put forward really incredibly smart ideas and had clearly understood everything that we were trying to go for with the Oversight Board. And so the thing that surprised me the most is that you can have a public consultation process over something that is so emotionally charged as Facebook and the decisions that we hold over people's ability to say things or not online. And it can be really constructive, and it can be civil, and it can be productive. And so to me, this whole process has really restored my faith in humanity to some extent. And I was really pleasantly surprised by the results that we received.
Wow, that's a good outcome from a feedback process. What were the biggest regional differences that you saw? Because you talked about how global this was, and I can imagine that there are some really huge differences between, I mean, we are seeing really massive differences between what people in Europe think should happen, people in America think should happen, and what people in the global South think should happen. So what were the biggest ones that stood out to you?
I mean, this is something that I anticipated, but was confirmed by our consultation, is that people in the global South, the global South is an imperfect term, and of course it's not culturally homogenous by any stretch of the imagination, but I would say activists, especially from the global South, who do not and cannot assume that they will have their rights protected, were extraordinarily concerned in terms of wanting the board to hew towards international human rights standards. And I would say much more so than in the U.S., where the emphasis is on the First Amendment. And also in Europe, to some extent, where free expression is not the number one most pressing concern. But it is the number one most pressing concern for a lot of activists across the global South who have seen their ability to have their speech be heard and not threatened by governments. That's really where they come from when they want to talk about the oversight board. How will this protect my ability to express myself freely? And so I think that really shows that they are coming from a place that doesn't assume that their rights necessarily will be protected. And I think that's a big difference.
For sure. But how much can the board really help in that kind of case? Because, I mean, you have specifically said in the charter that's been released that if something, leaving something up would be against the law, then that's outside of the purview of the board. Mm-hmm. So if it is a problem of people's rights not being protected because of governments or, authoritarian regimes or just more restrictive speech regimes, is the board even really going to speak to that issue at all?
Well, I mean, I do think that the board will be speaking towards expression issues. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the most common thing that the board will be speaking to. And so, yes, we have kind of carved out legal questions because we cannot bestow upon the board more legal authority than we ourselves have. And so it's not for a want of including it. It's just the reality that we just can't. But I do think that there is a value to having a lot of similar cases go before the board that maybe fall completely outside of legal decisions. There are only so many cases that courts can hear, just like there are only so many cases that the board will be able to hear. There are a lot of cases that are not settled by local law and that are not taken up by powerful authorities in the government. A lot of cases that don't receive press attention or media attention or government attention, but that are really important. And that's why I think that that the board can add some value in providing access to those who don't have the megaphone of the press, for example, but still have serious and significant cases that should be heard.
Okay, so you just mentioned that the board will only hear a certain limited number of cases, and that's obviously just physics or
math
time. Yeah. Okay. Physical limitations and the function of time and aging. And you also spoke earlier, though, that one of the big things that you got in the feedback process was the need to have policy influence. Mm-hmm. And sort of in the final charter, that is there, but it's somewhat limited. So correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I read the charter, the decision in the particular case is binding.
Correct.
So whatever the board says about that particular piece of content is binding. Then for identical pieces of content in parallel contexts, I believe is the wording, Facebook will implement it to the extent that it's technically and operationally feasible, which, yes. I mean, I don't know what that means. Maybe you can enlighten me about the meaning of technical and operational feasibility. Sure. And then finally, in the matter of policy recommendations, that's not binding. Facebook will implement it or it will respond to the board about what it has done in response to its policy recommendations. So the binding nature of the board is actually fairly limited. Why is that? And what assurance do we have that this board actually will have policy impact?
So, I mean, I think people are hearing non-binding as toothless. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those two things are equal. So, yes, we will make – the board will have binding decisions on individual content decisions, and I think that's fairly consequential. So let's say we took down a very highly politically charged piece of content that we there was a lot of pressure to take down. And the board says –
I can't think of any of those I can't think that of any come of, up on Facebook ever.
I can't think of any examples that come to mind. But let's say we did that, and the board said, no, that's not consistent with your community standards and, more importantly, the values that sit on top of the community standards. We would have to restore that to the platform. That's a huge decision in those types of cases. So, so that's on that piece. On the policy recommendation piece, we talked about this quite a bit. And I think one of the issues is that these, the board members are going to be approximately 40 people from all sorts of disciplines, but not necessarily from computer science backgrounds who understand exactly all of the nuances and nitty-gritty of what's technically feasible to do. And so you could foresee a policy recommendation that's completely unimplementable. And so that's sort of, that's one of the main reasons that we decided on advisory policy recommendations. The other is we still do have a duty to, a fiduciary duty that we hold to our shareholders. So the board could issue a decision, a policy recommendation that says you need to get rid of newsfeed, or you need to limit Instagram only to photos and no videos, right? I mean, these are pretty extreme cases, but let's say that they did.
Or, for example, they could say Facebook Live is something that, you know, has lots of, I mean, those, the hypotheticals you throw out are pretty outrageous, but people are talking about whether the risks involved in Facebook Live are a tolerable risk to have.
Right.
And that is a pretty significant decision for a platform to make.
Yeah. It is a pretty significant decision, and I'm not sure if it's the right place for a board that's not as intimately aware of all of our technical processes that behind to make those decisions. And furthermore, we have to own our responsibility to write our own policies, for good or for ill. The criticism that comes with that should also be directed at us, because it's our platform and we set the policies and we should also own those decisions. I think the number one criticism of the board is that people think that we're outsourcing decisions to this external body. And so what does it mean if we're outsourcing policy writing to this body and saying, oh, no, we don't want to do it because it's too hard, so we should have these 40 smart people do it? I think to me that sounds not something seems off with that and doesn't accord with the fact that we have created this platform. We have 2.7 billion users and we owe a large responsibility to them.
So what happened to the name Facebook Supreme Court? When did that die?
Well, it was never officially the name, I would say. It was a metaphor. It was a metaphor. And I think the reason that originally the words Facebook Supreme Court put together in succession was ever used was because it's hard to envision what this would look like. And there are some similarities because this will be at the top of an appeals process. There will be learned people deciding on very tough value balancing questions. And so in that regard, the metaphor is correct. The name is imperfect because it sets expectations far above what could possibly be delivered, right? And the Supreme Court has this governmental finality about it that I think is not exactly right for what this will be. This oversight board is a function of the digital age in which things are moving quickly, in where we can't necessarily have 9 esteemed justices sitting in perpetuity and essentially until they're 89 years old and close to shuffling off this mortal coil. I'm not sure if that's quite the right metaphor always for what this will be or how flexible it will have to be to changing natures in the digital landscape. And so we named it the Oversight Board, which is a bit mundane, but I think it's more accurate in terms of it will literally be a board of certain people and they will be charged with oversight of our decisions. So
so not catchy, but accurate, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't set our marketing teams loose on creating the most creative of names, but hopefully it conveys like the level of scope and ambition that we have for the body.
Just picking up on something that you mentioned in that saying that it sits at the top of an appeals process. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether this might be outside what you and your team are thinking about right now. But one of the things that one of the big criticisms of the board is that it will hear so few cases. We've talked about that. Yep. And there are still so many millions of micro decisions, sure, that get made that really affect people and really have an impact. And that the appeals process that Facebook currently has, well below the board, has a lot of deficits and a lot of people feel that they don't get a proper hearing. Yeah. And there's inconsistency. Is there going to be, I mean, the board can't be an answer to that.
Yeah.
Those due process concerns. So is there any movement or thinking about addressing that more systemically across the board for users, mm-hmm, or is that outside what your team's looking at the moment? Mm-hmm. What's the position on that?
So I think there are two ways that I'll answer this question. One is that there can be multiple problems and multiple solutions. It doesn't mean you solve the oversight board and you don't do anything on internal appeals, right? The company is large. It has resources to address both what needs to happen at the top of our appeals process, which is the oversight board, and it has resources and smart people working on the internal appeals process that we have currently. It's not a zero-sum game. You focus on the oversight boards, and so you can't focus on internal appeals. I think that that's one misunderstanding. I think the second thing is that the oversight board has transparency banked into it on a number of levels in the process that can help illuminate what we need to do on the processes that lead up to decisions that go to the board. So yes, the board will only be able to hear a few dozens of cases a year, especially when it's first starting up. At the same time, what I envision the board doing, and I think which will be illuminated more in the bylaws that'll come out later this year, is that it will also issue reports, periodic reports on the cases that it heard, but also the cases it didn't hear. So, for example, we're expecting, and I think a lot of observers are expecting, that what people will be appealing a lot are cases related to hate speech. What if that's not borne out by the actual appeals process? What if people are really concerned about is bullying and harassment? And so even if the board is only hearing a small number of cases, and maybe originally they look at hate speech cases because those are usually, you know, they can be very difficult, the reporting that happens can inform how they select cases in the future. So if the vast majority of appeals that are coming to the board are actually on bullying and harassment or actually on other dangerous organizations or other areas of our community standards, then that can inform how it moves forward. And also it can be an interesting and illuminating data point for how we focus our resources in our current internal appeals processes.
Okay, so you mentioned the bylaws are going to come out sometime later this year. Mm-hmm. I think there's the chairs of the board are going to be mm-hmm. – walk us through the timeline. When are we going to see the first case?
Yeah. So, okay. So in we're in October now. Last month we released the revised charter, which gave a lot more detail on the mandate and operations and functions of the board. Now we're really moving towards operationalization in October and November. And so – in the course of the next 2 months, month and a half, we'll be releasing information like the bylaws, the code of conduct for the board. We'll probably also be introducing new documents around the trust that will house the board, and that's a critical component of the board's independent judgment. And then in December, we'll actually be announcing the first group of members, including the co-chairs and up to 15 or 20 so members who will comprise the first group for the for this new body. So with that timeline in mind, I think the board will realistically start hearing cases in the beginning of next year, January or February.
Okay. Wow. That's been a super fast process for, you know, building the rule of law from scratch. Well done. Congratulations. One thing that, you know, I and others have speculated about is that this project is somewhat an effort or a hope to fend off regulator interest. You don't have to, you know, confirm or deny, but I'm just wondering if you have any sort of, what has the regulator response been to this project? Do people view it with suspicion, or is it reassuring? Is it threatening? What's kind of the feeling that you're getting from governments around the world about this?
I think it's changed, actually. I think there was skepticism, just as there was high skepticism from civil society organizations and academics. I think government officials also saw this with high skepticism when we first announced this and said that we were going to build this thing. And I think also there was a question of, are you doing this just to forestall regulation? Are you doing this to take to do the job that regulators should do? I think the more information that we put out, the more that there is a realization that these are complementary. We've said that we, as a company, we welcome regulation. We welcome government support in figuring out where we should draw these really difficult lines. And that still holds. I think the oversight board is also an attempt to say, look, there are a lot of questions that fall outside of what's actually been regulated or what will be regulated, but are still really difficult questions. So I think that this board will fill a space that's not covered by regulation necessarily. And we've said that specifically because legal questions are out of scope. But there are many pieces of content that are not covered by legal decisions that are still really tough. And so to me, it shows that we're not just like passing the buck to government regulators and saying, okay, in a year, 2 years, 3 years, whenever down the line you tell us what to do, we're saying, no, there are a lot of decisions that have to be made now and have to be made urgently and have to be made with external input. And so that's sort of where the oversight board fits in with that.
Right. Urgently, as in perhaps before 2020 or perhaps during 2020, might be a consideration, but I won't make you respond to that. What about other companies? Something that, like, I think it was Nick Clegg and Mark Zuckerberg have mentioned in various announcements surrounding this is that you're building it such that other companies would be able to join, and you're, you know, you have the hope that this might be the model for the industry, that kind of thing. Are you getting any nibbles on that front, or what have other companies sort of thought about this?
Well, I don't think they're maniacally laughing at us anymore, so that's probably
progress.
That's probably progress. I would say that it's being taken seriously as a laboratory of experimentation, but also, you know, I think there is an incentive for other platforms to take a wait and see approach, which seems pretty natural and probably what
let
I
you guys be the canary in the coal mine.
Yes,
on this one.
Yes, what I would do as well if I were at another company. So that makes rational sense. However, I do think that they understand that we are investing a ton of resources into this. And one of the huge pieces of feedback that we heard throughout the global consultation was, don't build just for Facebook. If you're going to pour all these resources into it, figure out a way that it could potentially serve to help advance the industry overall. And so that's why we've set up the governance structure that we outlined in our September newsroom post, where the board will actually have an independent trust, and that trust will essentially house the board and the board staff. And so we've set it up in this way so that if other companies say, gosh, Facebook, this turned out to be the most brilliant idea and it's working so well that we want to join too, they can. My husband is into video games, and so I liken it to an expansion pack. So we're putting out the main video game, I would say, and we're structuring it in such a way that other companies could come in if they so choose, and they could also provide funding to the trust, and they could also start referring cases to the board.
Okay. So The last question then is, let's do a pre-mortem. It's 2 years from now. Other companies have definitely not joined because this has been a miserable failure. The board launched. It garnered no legitimacy for Facebook. Mm-hmm. It was enveloped in controversy from the very start. Everyone was dissatisfied. What went wrong? What if you are sitting here 2 years from now, what is it that made the board fail?
So I think about this a lot, and it's something that before I go to bed, I think about the board. When I wake up, I think about the board. In my dreams, I think about the board. And I think during all of those moments, the thing that I could see potentially irreparably damaging the board is if they don't have a unity of purpose. And if it turns out to be that everyone on the board is there to further his or her own career, for example, or to make a name for himself or herself, then I would really wonder if that we were ever able to build that camaraderie and that sense of purpose among the board as a cohesive whole. So this is where I will invoke the Supreme Court. You know, they don't make, generally speaking, they don't make political pronouncements outside of...
Oh, yeah. No, never. Never heard never, a political decision from the U.S. Supreme Court.
But they don't. Like, they don't give interviews to the Wall Street Journal, for example, and say, you know, I think that this is wrong because I'm a registered Democrat, etc. Like, they don't. They have protocol, right? And they do things together. They know each other as people outside of work. I mean, you think about the relationship between Ginsburg and Scalia, right? Famed relationship that extends beyond their huge ideological differences. And I think that's why that court works. And I think that's why generally deliberative bodies do work, is because decisions come from a place of principles, and that it's not personal, and that people are not doing it necessarily for gain. During our consultation, we were told by our Brazilian stakeholders, please don't televise the deliberations because that can create a really divisive atmosphere in which people, you know, this is what they say. I've never actually watched a Brazilian Supreme Court deliberation, but what we've heard is that, you know, really have it be about the deliberations and not necessarily about people trying to further their careers or generally trying to make a name for themselves or increase their own visibility out of this. And I think we can mitigate for that by putting in strong processes in place. Of course, you know, people are people, but I think that's where you really have to rely on process.
It's interesting to me that your greatest fear, your, you know, 2 years from now failure is something within the board, because I think my greatest fear and a lot of observers' greatest fear is the relationship between the board and Facebook, and this idea that, you know, if it doesn't work, it's because Facebook either didn't take it seriously or didn't approach the experiment in good faith. You know, these phrases like what's technically and operationally feasible, you know, we have concerns about how that's going to be interpreted. And so I guess my question for you, which seems like a bit of an unfair last question, but is, you have faith that it's not going to be a breakdown along those lines that imperils this project?
I mean, I have faith. I guess a skeptic could say it's because you, Zoe, work, you know, 12 to 14 hours a day on the board. And so it's easy to see this as a thing that works when that's like your sole focus for the majority of your waking hours. However, I totally understand that fear. I understand the fear that maybe Facebook won't implement these so-called non-binding policy advisory recommendations. And maybe we've left all these hooks where Facebook can have this board and to say that they have a board, but they're not actually putting their money where their mouth is. I get that. And what I say in response is, we have built in so much public transparency around this process, not only having the board issue public decisions, but also having Facebook having to respond publicly. So if we're not doing what we're saying we have committed to, it will be fairly obvious. And I hope that you, Evelyn,
I'll be watching.
We'll be watching, as well as the thousands of people whom we've consulted and the thousands to even more people who know about this and know how public we've been about it. And so that's where I think the public accountability piece is really crucial, and where I hope that our strong civil society is able to hold our feet to the fire in terms of saying, Facebook, you said that you committed to this. You said you committed to it at the highest level. And now we want to see you actually do that.
Great. Well, I, along with many others, no doubt, will be watching with great interest. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Evelyn. Thank you.
You've been listening to the third episode of Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast's new miniseries on disinformation. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare Podcast feed, and remember to check for new episodes every Thursday. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Zoe Darme. Our music is performed by Sophia Gann. Our audio engineers are Jacob Schultz and Michaela Vogel. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. And as always, thanks for listening.